welcome to NC State's Audio Abstract. I'm your host, Tracy Peake. How and why do planets look the way they do? What can Earth tell us about other planets and vice versa? Paul Byrne is an assistant professor of planetary geology here at NC State who studies how tectonic, volcanic, and impact processes shape planetary surfaces and what they can teach us about both distant worlds and our own. In part one of this two-part podcast, I'll be speaking with Paul about what planetary geology is. In part two, we'll explore fascinating facts about our solar system neighbors. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
First, let's get a good definition of what planetary geology is and what it can help us understand better about planets in our solar system.
Sure. So planetary geology is pretty much what it sounds like. It's the geology of other planets. But it's worth kind of diving a little deeper into that to get some nuance. Until about maybe the 1960s, planets were essentially the exclusive domain of astronomers because they were the folks with the technology, telescopes, to see them. It was only in the 60s and 70s and on when we began to send spacecraft to visit other worlds that we began to recognize these as planets in their own right, rather than just points of light in space. So planetary geology as a discipline is fairly young compared with, say, geology as a whole. But it basically is the same thing. It's us understanding what the surfaces look like and why they look like them. And what's really powerful about planetary geology is that it does help us understand other worlds and the processes that shape them, that go into making them in a way that we could not possibly otherwise get, because it's really hard to visit other worlds. We've only put human beings in one other body. So how do we work out what we're seeing on Mars or Mercury or icy satellites around Jupiter? By sending spacecraft there and imaging their surfaces and taking a host of other measurements, we apply our understanding of the geology of Earth to these other worlds. If we see landforms or processes that look similar, then we can reasonably infer that the same processes made those landforms in those other worlds. So that's what we do. We take geology of Earth and we apply it to other planets.
Okay, and one of those things, you said we figure out what's going on, obviously, by looking at other planets, because we don't go there. It would be neat if we could, but we don't. So one of the processes that we know sort of shapes our world are tectonic plates and the movements of these things. How can you deduce whether or not that's happening on another planet when all you have is a picture?
I think that's the question, because one of the things that we've long wondered about is, are plate tectonics important for life on Earth? And we might come back to that in a few minutes. So it's made sense that we've been trying to see if there's evidence of that same process that's so important in our world operating in other worlds. It turns out there are some things we can look for from orbit or from even farther away, from, say, if we fly a spacecraft past something. The plate tectonic pattern on our world has some fairly distinctive shapes, some, you know, what we call morphologies that we can look for. We see in the middle of the oceans where the oceans are coming apart, that makes a very distinctive shape. Where the plates dive down under each other, say when they reach continental, you know, perimeters, that also has a form of shape that we can look for. So there's sort of volcanic landforms, there are tectonic landforms, there's a shape signature that characterizes plate tectonics on Earth, and we look for that exact signature in other worlds. And importantly, although we see some really interesting stuff and we see some variations on a theme, we don't yet see plate tectonics operating on any other world in this solar system. And that really raises the question of how important this process on Earth that is so important to shaping Earth, to regulating its climate, to allowing different species to propagate across the planet. We don't know how important that process is for life, but it is important to note that it is the only world in which we know there's life is also the only world that has this process.
Well, let's dig a little bit deeper into the idea of plate tectonics being important to life on Earth.
Plate tectonics have this really important function. We think they are really important to help regulate the temperature of Earth by drawing material, let's say, on the seafloor. Often this material is carbon-rich because it's basically composed of the shells of the little creatures that are in the oceans. And as that material falls onto the ocean floor, it's then driven down like a conveyor belt into these subduction zones, and it's brought into the planetary interior. And so Earth has a way of, it releases things like carbon, which is a greenhouse gas through volcanoes, but it also has a way of keeping that some of that carbon trapped in the ground through the subduction process. Now, we don't know that plate tectonics is a critical component of having a habitable world. But certainly on our world, it's done a very effective job, but generally speaking, over the last couple of billion years that we know this process at least has operated, of keeping Earth's temperature fairly well regulated.
So while it's not the key, we know that it plays a part. And so if it's not present somewhere else, That's one more strike against that planet being
Absolutely.
Able to...
It's, we may not be able to answer the question definitively for quite a long time. Do you need plate tectonics to have a world that could potentially host life, that could be habitable? Mm-hmm. But it certainly seems to help when we look at Earth compared with, say, its planetary neighbors.
Okay, so what are some of the other criteria we're looking for another planet to be able to support life?
So NASA has a fairly broad idea of what we define as habitability. And it's important to say that this does not necessarily mean that life is present. So right now, we're probably quite a ways off being able to say for sure that that's life, because we don't know for sure yet how best to develop an instrument or a machine or a device that could definitively recognize life on Earth. We know it when we see it, but how do you build it into a spacecraft that could definitively identify life? So what we look for instead is we look for habitable environments, environments that we think could support life as we know it. And it's really important to get this out there too. This is life that we might be able to reasonably recognize, that we'd understand the chemistry of it, how it evolves. There could be some bizarro forms of life out there, but if we don't know what they are, we can't reasonably start looking for them.
Right.
So the three things that we kind of lay on the table that we think you need to have a habitable condition are: you need liquid water, because we know that is crucial to life on this world. You need some kind of energy source. It could be volcanic, it could be lightning, something that's going to drive chemical reactions. And you need some of that chemistry in the first place. You need some kind of organic compounds. We know that carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, sulfur, there's a host of critical compounds on Earth and elements on Earth that appear to be crucial to help drive biological processes. So we reasonably assume that we would need those things as well. So you need liquid water, you need a source of energy, you need organic compounds. So they are the three things that the kind of trifecta we would look for on a world. So identifying the possibility of liquid water might not be enough. Identifying the possibility of organic compounds might not be enough. But anywhere where we think those three things could occur or have occurred in the past together certainly raises our interest in that place as being either a currently habitable or possibly once habitable environment.
And like we said, plate tectonics is a part of that. When we're talking about the plate tectonics, could that ever serve as an energy source? The movement, the friction, would that be enough of an energy source to maybe drive some of these chemical reactions?
So one of the things, so it might be, and unfortunately, because we only have one world, we don't know for sure, but it could be in two ways. One of the ways is that the plate tectonics process on Earth itself is driven by this balance between you have a lot of energy inside Earth and it's in its mantle, and some of that energy is put into moving this brittle, thin layer of where these plates exist on the surface, and it moves them and jostles them around the place. And one of the big consequences of plate tectonics is that you get a lot of volcanic activity. So the plate tectonics process itself might not be what's driving the energy, but it might be one of the outcomes of there being energy inside a world. Another outcome being volcanoes, because areas where we know there's volcanic activity, certainly they could be anywhere from volcanically active parts of the surface of Earth right now, or even hydrothermal vents at ocean floors where hot water that's circulating through the nearer surface of the ocean floor. There could be volcanic activity and igneous activity below that, and driving the water through because you have that energy there might be a critical place in which you could look for life. In fact, it's been surmised, at least, that maybe some life on Earth originally started at hydrothermal vents, and you don't really get them, we don't think, without plate tectonics. So whether it's driving it or it's a kind of another outcome of it, we don't quite know. But certainly they're the kinds of places that we would pay a lot of attention to understand habitability.
Okay. All right, great. So once we've looked for the features, you know, energy like volcanoes, extinct volcanoes, or volcanic activity, what can you learn about these planets by looking at them and saying, okay, this planet may have had, you know, a volcano at one point or a tectonic shift? Like, what can we tell from that?
So one of the biggest things we can tell is how common what we see on our world is throughout the solar system.
Okay.
So, for example, one of the things we've recognized in the last few decades is that we find evidence of volcanic activity almost everywhere we look in the inner solar system. So the inner solar system, as we generally count it, starts from Mercury, the planet closest to the sun, and goes out to roughly, say, the main asteroid belt, basically the barrier between Mars and then the start of the really giant planets, Jupiter.
Okay.
And if we look at Mercury, Venus, Earth, and the Moon, and Mars, all five of them have evidence of having volcanic activity. So already that tells us that rocky planets might characteristically have volcanic activity. Now, there's no evidence that volcanic activity is presently operating on Mercury, and pretty much the same can be said for the moon and for Mars. We have a massive open question about volcanic activity taking place today on Venus. We don't know for sure. We've seen tantalizing evidence of. We have to go back with more capable instrumentation to be able to be sure. And of course, we know there's volcanic activity happening on Earth this very moment.
Right.
But the idea that volcanism is a fundamental planetary process is something I think we can now say is true, because everywhere we look in the inner solar system, we see evidence for this. Same for tectonic activity. We see evidence in all five of these worlds. Their outer brittle crust has been broken. It's been pulled apart, pushed together, in some cases side to side. Not the plate tectonics thing we see on Earth, but definitely evidence of tectonic activity, which more broadly just means the crust is being broken through a variety of processes. And of course, we see impact strikes everywhere, except notably on Earth. And this brings me to kind of another aspect of why planetary geology is so powerful. I said earlier on that we understand other planets' geology by comparing the things we see on the surface with what we see on Earth. Therefore, we apply Earth geology and our understanding of Earth geology to other worlds. But it works both ways. And what's really interesting about Earth is that because it has plate tectonics, because it's a dynamic world, even though we think it's around 4.5 billion years old, there are virtually no parts of its surface left that old, which means the very oldest parts of Earth history are long since gone. They've been subducted through plate tectonics. They've been eroded. They've been destroyed through vegetation or through climate and all the various upheavals we've had on Earth, which means that we don't know what Earth's earliest days looked like. However, worlds like the Moon, Mars, Mercury in particular, some of those worlds had a lot of activity for the first few 100 million years of their life. But after about 20% of their life, that activity mainly came to an end, which means parts of their surfaces do preserve that ancient record of probably what Earth must have looked like, but is long since lost to us. So not only are we understanding things like, oh, there's volcanoes and there are asteroid strikes and there are tectonic landforms on these other worlds, we're able to say that surely must have been what Earth looked like 4.2 billion years ago, the evidence for which on our world now is long since lost.
That's fascinating. So we've kind of touched on this, that a planet needs to have plate tectonics and the energy source and that kind of thing. If a planet, I guess the main question here is, so a planet does have to be geologically active to support life. On a planet like Mercury that just looks like a dead rock in space, is there anything going on under the surface there that we can tell now, or is that over?
So it's probable that some stuff is going on. So what we know from computer models, for example, and even evidence in the geological record on Earth, is that if there's any heat in the interior of a world, there's going to be some amount of energy to do something. And we know that Mercury's interior must be warm today, because Mercury is the only other inner solar system body, aside from Earth, that has its own internally generated magnetic field. And that's a big question. We don't quite know when it started. We don't know what's quite driving it. We think on Earth it's a convection in the outer liquid iron core that's helping generate this dynamo. We assume the same must be true for Mercury. We can go down all these different paths to why Mars and Venus don't appear to have magnetic fields today, and we don't quite know why that is. But the take-home message is, for Mercury to have a magnetic field, it must have a hot interior. So it's still got some kind of energy, and it may have another few billion years left of that energy. But the extent to which that energy in the deep interior gets to the surface and drives volcanic activity or drives tectonic deformation, it probably is very, very low levels. I wouldn't say never that there's nothing going to happen on the surface of Mercury, but if it is, it's taking place over very long periods of time, probably with huge spaces in between. Now, depending on something that I teach my students is that when you come into a geology class for the first time, you think pretty normally about deep time, and the pyramids seem very old because they are very old. But when you become a geologist, suddenly the idea of deep time changes completely. And in planetary geology, often we consider things a billion years old as relatively young, just because we have fairly good indications that most of the really interesting stuff, at least in the inner solar system, happened a really long time ago. So if I say to you that there might only be an eruption every 2 or 3 million years, to a geologist, that means that it's just dormant, that it's low-level activity. To a normal person, that means this thing may as well be extinct. So right. There could be some evidence that some small shaking of the surface of Mercury or the Moon, Mars, maybe some small volcanic eruptions on Mars, but nothing of the scale that we see Earth today, and I suspect Venus. But as I say, we really have a massive gap in our understanding of Venus and its properties. And I think Venus is probably a more dynamic and active world than we recognize it is. But certainly if you compare the other three worlds, Mercury, the Moon, and Mars, most of their exciting stuff happened a very long time ago.
Right.
But it does tell us that what we're familiar with today hasn't always been that way. It isn't always going to stay the same. And that's one of the values, I think, in teaching people geology in general, is that it does give folks, I think, an appreciation of what we call deep time and how what we look today and what we're familiar with really isn't necessarily what you've always had or always will have. And planetary geology is certainly a really humbling way of learning that lesson.
I've been speaking today with Paul Byrne, an assistant professor of planetary geology here at NC State. I'm Tracy Peake. This has been Audio Abstract. Thanks for listening.